This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. Value Hive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive. This week, I chat with Shomik Ghosh, principal at Boltstart VC. Shomik spends his time analyzing seed stage enterprise software companies, and I can't think of a better person to give a crash course on that space than him. We spend over an hour diving deep into enterprise software. We follow Shomik as he outlines his framework for evaluating enterprise software slide deck, which is attached in the show notes below. You have to read it. It's amazing. We also touch on a few misconceptions within the space and finish with Shomik's favorite part of the enterprise software stack and where he's investing at Boltstart VC. I couldn't have been happier with the way this podcast turned out, and it's one of the few podcasts that I'll actually listen to a few times. And we managed to sneak in a Mike Rowe reference. So for any of those Dirty Jobs fans out there, you're really going to love the end of this episode. I hope you enjoy, and Merry Christmas. All right, I've got Shomik Ghosh on the podcast. He's a principal at Boltstart VC, and he is the quote-unquote guru savant for all things enterprise software. And it's something that Shomik and I were just actually talking about before we hit record, is that it's almost like this crazy buzzword that hasn't been around over the last 5 years. And then all of a sudden, it's like everyone's talking about enterprise software. Everybody's got it in their slide deck and everybody wants to invest in these companies. So Shomik, thanks so much for coming on. I'm excited to dive into enterprise software. But before we do that, talk to us about, you know, who you are, how'd you get started, and how'd you end up at Boltstart?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on, Brandon, and really enjoy your podcast and the talks I've heard previously. So honored to be on. Not sure I'm a guru, but I'll try my best. At Boltstart, we are seed stage enterprise software investors. And when we say seed stage, literally, we actually are often the first check into our companies. So it's when a founder is coming up with an idea, we hope to work with them at that stage to help them think through hiring talent, early design partners, product marketing, messaging, everything about that early stage of the business. That's what really gets us excited about it. And so that's what we do at Boltstart every day is work with founders who make us look good, frankly, all across the world. And it's a pleasure to do that as a day job, and couldn't ask for anything better.
How'd you get into Boltstart? What was your background? Is this something you've always wanted to do, or did you kind of serendipitously stumble upon it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say VC in broadly was something I serendipitously stumbled upon. You know, I grew up on the East Coast. Frankly, in the East Coast, it was all about investment banking. Like that's what was in my mind and kind of hedge funds. And so, at first I was doing sales and trading and fixed income, got really interested in tech right around Facebook's IPO and was trying to understand how people were valuing Facebook. And I thought the best way to do that was to do tech M&A. So I moved out to California, to San Francisco, and that really opened my eyes up to what was venture, right? And so since there, for the past like 6 years, I've been in and around the venture ecosystem, whether at startups or at the growth stage, and now at Boltstart, where we're at the earliest formation of a company.
When you were first diving into this tech community and this idea of, you know, trying to understand these tech companies, value these tech companies, how did you go about that? How did you, leverage any resources or just kind of use any mental models to think like, okay, I've got these companies here, they're tech, they might not be making that much money, but you're trying to understand the operating leverage involved.
Yeah. So, I would say one of the most important things from my standpoint in general in tech investing is to really understand how the product is fitting into an end user's workflow. And we'll talk about this more, why that's important for, these product-led growth companies and these sort of more bottoms-up models, but it's also equally important for these top-down models too, right? Because a CTO is buying it because it's helping digital transformation, it's helping realize certain business outputs that they're trying to get, those business outputs are tied to real humans, right? And so what you need to understand is, again, how is that end user going to use it? Why is it important for them to use it? And how is it changing what they did previously? So that's really what I kind of focus on, whether it's public markets, private markets, I mean, whatever markets, right? It's always trying to understand from the product standpoint, how important is this product to a certain end user? What does the competition look like? And why would this product be able to win versus others out there? And so as long as I think you get that nailed down, you can kind of find some of these winners.
That's awesome. And it actually just made me think about this idea of where, you know, how does a person use it? What are your kind of thoughts and maybe just ideas around the startup companies that end up being successful for products and services that weren't originally there, like Slack, for instance, you know, even certain aspects of, you know, it really just anything on How I Made This with Guy Raz, it seems like, you know, it wasn't their first iteration. How do you think about that structurally, even from an investment standpoint, where you find a company, you're like, you know what, it's got these pieces, but it's what might actually make it a cash cow isn't what it's doing right now.
Yeah. So, You know, while we did talk about product and why that's so important, right? Again, what is a product? It's human coordination building software, right? So it's humans going around working together to kind of create something. And I think we always kind of abstract that away, but that's why culture and all these, you know, kind of softer skills that we used to think of previously are so important to actually understanding why a company may be successful in the future. So for me, again, it's culture, it's product, and then it's most importantly also founders, right? So who are these people? What's driving them to go and build this company? Why are they passionate about it day in, day out? And really, have they lived the pain behind what they're solving, right? And so in the case of Slack, what's pretty funny is, you know, they built the gaming company, but why did they build chat? Well, they need to communicate with people that they were playing the game with, right? Yep. So that's directly born from a pain that was from their first product. And so, you know, it would be crazy to say like, hey, somebody saw how big Slack could be when they were a gaming company, right? Like that's obviously insane. But what someone can say is, hey, we backed Stuart and team because we knew that they were special people who had a vision of how products would serve end users. And with that, we were able to work with them through pivots, stay with them to be able to help achieve their goals. And that's why, you know, always when you back these founders, they figure out a way when they get blocked by regulation, when they get blocked by a competitor, when all these things, they figure out a way to shift the company to achieve success.
Yeah. And it's almost like the Southwest Airlines founder. Is it Herb Keller? I feel like I'm getting that Herb name wrong. Okay. Yeah. Herb Keller. Yeah. I mean, he's the perfect example. He went through dozens and dozens of lawyer battles to try to get Southwest to fly in certain areas. And it's interesting how what you said about backing founders and backing people, that's so much harder to do than just looking at a term sheet and trying to figure out margins and cash flows and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we unfortunately don't have, when we invest in companies, we usually actually don't even have a product to look at. So it's hard to say what is the end state of this company going to look like. But what you can bet on is, again, the founders and their ability to have magnetism around them that attracts capital, customers, talent, advisors, and resources. And so when you have that special combo, that's really what unlocks the power in the future. There's all different archetypes and personas that enable that. So it's not like any one cookie cutter thing. Like founder market fit is a very important point and something we'll talk about even with like different go-to-market models out there, why certain go-to-market models make sense for certain founders. Like Benioff is, you know, I don't know if you put him in a product-led growth company, if he would have had the same success as he did being a top-down sales company, right? Because his magnetism draws towards building relationships and doing that sort of boardroom type sale. And so that's something where I'm always thinking about is that founder go-to-market fit actually is something that, you know, we've been studying more and more.
That's so interesting. I haven't, because all the time you just hear product market fit. You hear that, you know, unanimously, but you don't necessarily hear, or maybe it's just because I haven't filtered it out, but you don't hear that, you know, the founder market fit based on personalities. I think that's super insightful. Do you now, when you judge, I guess is a bit of a harsh word, but when you evaluate these founders, Do you ever try to invert the process and say, okay, what don't we want to see from a founder? What don't we want to see from a future company leader? And what are some of those potential red flags? What do they look like?
Yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily that we ask like, what don't we want to see? It's more of, given this person and what we think their superpowers are, why are they going to be able to succeed? And what other things do they need to help help them succeed, right? To help them bring out success. And so a lot of times when we're evaluating a founder, some of those constraints may be either one, areas that we can't help with, or two, maybe we believe that there's certain constraints that for some reason won't be able to be overcome. And so for that reason, we'll kind of say, hey, this is not a fit for us, right? But somebody else will see that same founder and that same company and be like, oh my God, like we know exactly how to do this. This is, you know, and so that's what makes it so interesting and exciting. So really what we're looking for is, again, trying to understand, like the question we always ask ourselves is, if this founder, like, why is this the right founder or the right founders to tackle this problem? And if they get it right, how big can it be? Right. And it's kind of like you have to get past the skepticism in your mind to be like, if they go and create a new category which doesn't exist before, how big could it be? Right. And I go back to like all of these markets are a lot larger than we can ever comprehend once they start taking off. And the middle in between can have a lot of, you know, dead bodies. But you know, that's the exciting part, I think, about venture investing.
Yeah, and it's actually, this is a perfect segue into this idea of seed investing in private markets versus public market investing, in the sense of you're paid almost more so, and this maybe I'm wrong, but I think you're paid more in public markets to be skeptical than you are in private markets, because you need that optimism at the seed level. You have, like you said, almost, you know, barely no product, hardly any revenues, you know, stuff like that. So you get paid for optimism, where in the public markets, you get paid almost for skepticism and trying to figure out what could go wrong. Do you think that public investors and the alpha that will be generated over the next 10 to 20 years, do you think that's moving more towards what we're seeing in seed investing, where you need more of that optimism and maybe that's what's going to be more important than understanding what could go wrong? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think it does. You know, it's funny because the alpha generation all kind of, I think, means different things to so many different people, right? So, you know, I go back to Amazon at one point from its lows this year to its current highs is up 100%. It is a $1.6 trillion market cap, right? That is just so insane to comprehend, right? That there was a move of 100% in something that should be rationally priced by, I mean, everybody knows the company, everybody follows it, and still there was 100% swing. And so my, you know, the thing I go back to kind of is, you know, what is alpha generation? And for me, I think it's finding mispriced assets at all times. And so you can probably find, like, if you take a venture investing approach to public markets, you can definitely find, I would say, more alpha generation in the sense of, hey, here's a portfolio of companies. There's going to be certain ones that break out, and the magnitude to which they break out is going to be such that those gains are going to vastly outpace the rest of the portfolio, right? So there's that sort of mindset, which is interesting. But I think also at the same time, like, there's so much alpha to be found on a yearly basis, even following the companies that you know. Like, for me, my day job is obviously seed investing, and so I can't pay that much attention to diving into the nuances of a certain, you know, small cap or mid cap company.
Right.
So all I do is really just kind of look for, hey, when is Facebook, when is Microsoft, when is Amazon mispriced, and make a big bet on it when it is mispriced, right? Yep. And when that happens, I get really excited. Or like when Elastic is mispriced in the public markets compared to where I think it is because they're worried about the AWS threat, like I can make a big bet on Elastic, get tons of alpha, and then maybe exit if I think that now that risk is you know, fairly valued, right? And so those are kind of the ways I think about generating alpha.
And the idea of exiting investments both in a seed and public space is interesting, because I saw a tweet, I think it was literally last night, where I forget who tweeted it, but basically they said public investors would be better off if they invested the way venture investors do, where if a company continues to perform, they invest more money as a company grows. And you almost see the inverse, whereas a company reaches its quote unquote fair value, investors begin to take off some positions, begin to, you know, weight it down because it's becoming a bigger percentage of their portfolio. What are your thoughts on that idea where if something's working, you should still add to it the way that venture works, where, you know, if you add at the seed stage and they continue to crush it, you're going to raise money with them in the next round and the next round?
Yeah. So there's different constraints in each kind of environment, right? So in venture investing, there's only a finite amount of capital that can be put into a company at specified times, right? And so the reason for that is like, if a company's only raising every 2 years and that's your only chance to put money in, you better make sure that if that's your opportunity, you capitalize on that and make, as big of an investment as you can based on, you know, what you think the future opportunity is, right? So, you know, venture investing is really about finding these companies, investing in them for the long term and maintaining your ownership so that you're able to realize these returns in the future. I think in the public markets, what's different though, is that you don't necessarily have those same constraints, right? Like we said, you know, Amazon went from, you know, whatever, $800 billion market cap to $1.6 trillion in the space of a year, right? And in a highly liquid instrument. And so from that standpoint, I would say you can have a different assessment where you could say, well, now what do I think is priced into a certain stock? And do I think there's other companies out there that are mispriced and reallocate some of those to then balancing? So it's a different mindset because of the constraints applied to the different kind of arenas or environments.
It's almost like an exclusivity effect in venture where you don't know if you're going to be able to invest in another one of these at that round. But in public markets, it's, you know, like Warren Buffett says, you can always just wait for the other pitch. And there might not be that other pitch in venture, at least in the same way.
Yeah, I think absolutely, right? You had, Elastic came out, right, before Datadog, but then Datadog came out and there was a ton of alpha to be had in buying Datadog, right? So it's like, there's more opportunities in the public markets, whereas in the private markets, it's a bit more constrained.
Got it. Let's now switch to where we're going to spend the rest of this conversation, which is analyzing your awesome, awesome slide deck on your framework for evaluating enterprise software companies. So before we actually get into that framework though, what about enterprise software do you love that other people might not realize if they haven't invested in enterprise software before this year?
Yeah. You know, what excites me about enterprise software is the mission criticality of these systems, right? For me, again, when I talk about public market investing, again, since I have my day job, I'm trying to do the lowest cognitive load to find the companies that I think are going to be the outperformers, right?
Yep.
And the easiest way for me is to say, hey, this is a mission critical software system that a business would not be able to run on, would not be able to function if they didn't have this. And so for that reason, like, I want to find those companies, I want to invest in them, and I want to stay with them for the long term. And so that's really what excites me about software is you have these mission critical systems where there's so much stuff lying upon it and built upon it that you have these layers of dependencies and layers of things that are all kind of coordinating with each other. On top of that, you also have humans tweaking these systems such that like you just have this like beautiful, complex, adaptive system where, you know, there's all sorts of crazy things that can happen at any time, right? And so that's where I think, I just get really excited about enterprise software.
Yeah, no, that's the perfect intro. So let's kind of walk through your six steps, I guess, to how you evaluate software companies. And you can start it in, you know, kind of the high down or the top down level, and then we can dive into really your biggest misconceptions around enterprise software.
Yeah. So I would say the six steps I use are kind of one, first, like to have a qualitative understanding of the product, the industry, the culture, all these different things that require a little bit of, hand to hand work or boots on the ground type of work, which is, you know, you got to go talk to customers, you got to go talk to channel partners, you got to talk to employees, you got to talk to ecosystem participants, right? But if you do that, you can start to understand, again, what's the mission criticality of this? Why is this product better than others out of it? And just kind of what's happening within the company, those sort of qualitative aspects that really drive kind of the outperformance. Then you have kind of the business model and strategy, and those I would put broadly into two buckets, kind of, you know, the top down sort of model, and then more of a bottoms up model. And we can dive into those more in a little bit. Another important point that I will, you know, harp on constantly is alignment of cost structure. I think markets always weight certain things at certain times, more so than others. And right now, I would say the market's really, really heavily weighting product-led growth companies, rightfully so, because you have consumer-like dynamics to an enterprise software model that's stickier than you know, a lot of these consumer subscriptions would be. And so you get some powerful business models that get unlocked from that. But that doesn't mean that a top-down model is not equally valuable, right? And so it goes into more founder market fit, into the product fitting what the customers are looking for. And so there's a bunch of nuances to that that I think would be interesting to dive into more. You then have switching costs. How sticky is it to use? How hard is it to switch to something else? You have distribution, and for this, I always love to give the grocery store example, which is like, when you're going to buy laundry detergent and you look eye level, Tide is the only thing you see. You see different colors of Tide, right? You see Febreze Tide, you see whatever Tide, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the only thing you see at that eye level is Tide, right? And that's slotting fees, that's being in front of the customer. And that's the same reason and what I like to think about distribution for enterprise software. And then finally, after you go through all those components, then you start to use valuation, right? Mm-hmm. Which is at steady state, what free cash flow do I think this company will generate? And then what am I paying for that now? And so that's where I think a lot of the fun comes out, especially with the markets, you know, pricing fairly high multiples on these companies right now, is to really start to separate, you know, truly what do I think steady state free cash flow for this business is? And is it worth paying that right now, especially at what are perceived to be, you know, rather high multiples?
Got it. That's perfect. And one of the things I want to maybe go down a little bit of a rabbit hole on is this alignment of cost structure. So when you say that, what do you mean by alignment of cost structure? Do you mean from a firm standpoint, and how much an enterprise software charges to the firm, or is it something completely different?
Yeah. So so alignment of cost structure is a funny thing. Cause I think we talked about earlier, it's an interesting exercise. Like, what would Mark Benioff have been able to do as well as he has if he was leading Twilio rather than Salesforce? And this is something we'll never know, right? But but it's really interesting because Jeff Lawson is a developer through and through. Like, everything he does is about how do you serve developers in the best way? Even every single employee has to code up an app using Twilio's API, right? So there's all these interesting components that's baked into that culture versus Benioff and Salesforce, which, by the way, I believe Mark Benioff was a software engineer as well. But really, where his skill set is this just amazing personality that's able to get board members of Coca-Cola to listen to him and be like, this is someone who I trust and who I want to have, you know, helping me think through my strategy. And so where I think about alignment of cost structure is basically you have these two kind of prevalent models that exist right now in enterprise software. One is a bottoms up model where it's driven by the product. So again, that's Twilio, that's Datadog, that's numerous other companies that are out there, where basically a single end user is able to pick up this product, say, hey, we love this, whip out their credit card, and just start paying for it, right? And so it's very similar to paying for Spotify or YouTube Premium or any of these sort of things. And it's just consumerization of IT. The other standpoint is a top-down sales model, right? Which is more of you go to a CTO, a CIO, and say, hey, I understand that you have this problem. You want to cut costs. You want to increase revenue. You want to do all these different things. We have a product that we think will be able to unlock that. Let me show you how that's going to be able to do that. Right. So that's much more of a consultative selling motion rather than a end user go and try this out. And what you have with those two components, though, are very interesting. So let's say you have a top-down sales model where you're going and talking to a CTO.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, that probably takes a decent amount of time to do. It requires one, in pre-COVID times, you had to go fly out there, you had to go to dinner, you have a hotel room, you probably have multiple meetings, right? Then the CTO will talk to their director, who will then talk to, you know, all these different folks. And finally, maybe 9 months later, you'll get into procurement. If you think about all those front-loaded costs, you need to make sure that that customer is going to stick around for the next 5 to 10 years, right?
Because that's a high CAC.
Exactly.
A high upfront CAC, yeah.
It's a really high upfront CAC. And so this is what's so interesting about companies like Salesforce, ServiceNow, Workday, right? Is they are doing these highly strategic platform shifting company sales. But what they know on the back end is that this customer is going to stick with us for, you know, 5 to 10 years. And so they're okay spending a massive amount upfront and not having the payback on that customer acquisition cost be for anywhere from, you know, 1 to 2 years in some cases, because they're betting on, hey, the long-term free cash flow generation will come after year three or whatever. And so that's an aligned cost structure, is if you have a huge sales force where you're spending a lot on sales and marketing, but then you have something where the churn is low, even though it looks like you're spending a lot on sales and marketing, that's actually a right-sized cost structure, right? Because it fits the product that you're selling. The flip side is now if you have a bottoms-up one, you want to make sure, again, that that's aligned. So now this should be a higher velocity sale, right? So your sales and marketing cost, even if it's large in magnitude, what you should be seeing instead is most probably lower ACVs that have a lower sales cycle and enables you to have kind of a faster churn rate, right? And so if you're churning out more customers, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Like I remember there's a short report on Shopify at one point, and it was like, hey, there's so many people churning off of Shopify, right? And in reality, you now think back on it, like, why is Shopify doing so well? Because that's a feature of the platform. It is so easy to use. It's so product-led driven that me and you can say, like, you could have Brandon's t-shirt shop and I could have Shomik's t-shirt shop. We could spin it up. And if it doesn't work, guess what? We are a churned customer, but it costs them barely anything to get us to use the product. And so again, that's an aligned cost structure, right? Where they shouldn't have a huge amount on sales and marketing because they should have more spent on R&D to drive the product.
That is that part right there is going to be one where people need to go back and listen to again, because that's so important. Because when you go to analyze these companies, you can invert that and say, okay, if it's a bottoms up, like let's call it Shopify, and they're spending way more than they should on SG&A and they have high, you know, churn, we'll use that churn, then that's an issue. And then in the same way in a top-down, if you have really low SG&A spend and you've got high churn, well, then you're probably not doing enough. And it's just, that's so important because it changes the way, like Shopify, that's such a good example because people just see churn rate and they associate churn rate equals bad. What they don't know is that the churn rate, like you said, is actually a feature, not a bug of this bottoms-up approach. So is there any like better version, or is it just like kind of dependent? Like which one do you think offers better investment opportunities? Is it a bottoms up model or a top down model?
Yeah. And so that's the really interesting part, which is right now, again, the market is highly, highly weighting towards these product led bottoms up models. Right. And so, if we're talking about what's better, like it's hard to say, right. Cause it depends on your time frame, but certainly, at the same revenue level, a bottoms up company is getting a higher multiple on their revenue versus a top down model, right? Because people are looking at capital efficiency and things like that. But what's funny is that what we're betting on is long term returns, right? And so, what is a company going to be able to make, you know, 5, 10 years from now? And what's that return going to look like to me? And so, what's funny to me is like, I like both of them. Like in our portfolio, frankly, we have two companies like that approach the market in very different ways. I would say, you know, Sneak in our portfolio, which helps developers use open source code securely, they started from a very bottoms up. Every developer can go and test out the product, free to use, and then they start paying for it when they go past certain usage or want certain enterprise features. And then that's how the company expands, right? And now, obviously, there's more of a enterprise component to it because they're getting into large companies which want to, you know, have all these enterprise features. So they've layered on some sales, but in the beginning, it was much more of this bottoms up driven sort of approach. And then at the same time, we have Big ID, which just announced at a $1 billion valuation, where they are a top-down strategic sale. So they go into CTOs, CIOs, chief data officers, and they go and talk to them about, you know, hey, do you need to discover, you know, what are you doing with your data? Have you, do you understand where it is? Do you understand what's happening with that data, the PII that could be exposed? And let me help you with that, right? And so what's really interesting is, again, these are two different companies, different products, but both are executing incredibly well, doing awesome, and really helping their customers. So I think that's where both are great, right? We like both of them. Neither one is better. It just goes towards the founder, the team, what they're comfortable with, what the product is serving, what's the product doing for those end users, and what's the best way to approach that.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like a big lever in this discussion is lifetime value and making sure you get that right. And the way I think about that is, if you have Salesforce, let's say your Salesforce, you're doing the top down model, you're spending high CAC upfront. If you get that LTV wrong, and if you get that instead of 5 years that you think you're going to have the customer, it's down to 2 to 3. How do you think about that consequence in a world where technology seems to innovate so fast that what if in 2 years something comes along, not saying it's going to happen, but something comes along that beats Salesforce, and all of a sudden all the expenses that you did up front based on 5 years are now down to 2?
Yeah. So that's something you constantly got to look at and be thinking about. And so I think that's where we come into, probably I think the best way to look at that is switching costs. Right. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways that I would think about it is, okay, well, so let's say Salesforce has been out there for a while, right? But as you can see, like Dynamics 365 is a product that Microsoft has. Pretty much at this point now, that HubSpot has a CRM product. Like, there's so many companies out there with CRM products. And yet Salesforce still keeps on growing, right? And still keeps on retaining meaningful customers and doing quite well. So what's happening there, right? And that's something that's interesting to think about is, one, I think Salesforce did a lot of evangelism in the beginning to expand the market size, right? So now all of a sudden people are just like, wait, instead of writing on a notepad or in a Google sheet somewhere about like, hey, I met Brandon, he wants to purchase this software and here's where he lives and all this sort of stuff, I need to have a CRM that manages that, right? And it needs to integrate with certain systems and it needs to do all these certain things. And so for a large enterprise, you'll probably more likely go to Salesforce because you're like, hey, I need you to work with Microsoft Teams and Slack because I have different teams that use those. I need you to work with our billing system. I need you to work with our quote to cash system, right? All these sort of things. For a younger startup just starting out, maybe you're actually like, well, I don't need all that. I just need something that's actually pretty lightweight and the cost would be cheaper. And as it scales over time, maybe I'd be willing to pay more. So maybe I go with HubSpot, right?
Yeah.
And so those are kind of the different components to that. But I would say how you start to look at that is switching costs then. So what does it look like to switch from your CRM? It is a massive, massive pain in the ass, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if you ever implemented a CRM. I have at a previous company.
Yeah.
It took us, I think it was 9 months, maybe a full year before we had fully implemented. And even then, what we were doing was doing training for new staff members and for existing staff members to try and figure out how do you use this thing and how do you now start to get value. So we invested all of that. You think we're going to churn 3 years out? Like, there's no way, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what's really interesting, right? So I think, so to answer your question, like, it all goes to switching costs, which is, hey, new competitors are going to come out there, but if it's not that easy to switch, like Oracle databases are still a thing that people are using. It's very hard to switch off Oracle databases, right? And so, that's kind of how I think about it.
Yeah. It was funny when I used to work at an RIA here in Baltimore, actually. So it was funny. You mentioned that you're on the East Coast. Where on the East Coast were you?
In Jersey. Yeah, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So not too far. So yeah, I worked at an RIA in Baltimore, and the last year that I was there, we switched from Salesforce to like an RIA focused CRM. And it was like 6 to 8 months of not only just getting the data, but then training everybody. And then having everybody get logged in, get their own accounts. It's a big process. And as soon as we did that, I kind of understood, it was like, okay, I get why people stick with Salesforce. Like, I get, like, switching costs become real when you actually have to do them in real life.
This goes back to the scuttlebutt side of it, right? Because if you understand that from a qualitative standpoint, now all of a sudden you realize like you've lived that pain, right? So now all of a sudden you realize, wow, this CRM product is actually a little bit stickier than I think maybe other investors are giving them credit for, right? And so that's where you get these cool sort of nuances in the public markets, which allow people who have lived that pain or who have done the scuttlebutt research to make to kind of outperform.
Yeah, and it's funny too because we were a small team, and so what's interesting is that the switching cost pain is actually exponential, and it scales exponentially with the size of your team. So if, you know, instead of 8 to 12 that we were, if we were 24 to 36, it would have taken twice as long because you have to train twice as many people. It's kind of crazy. So let's go to the second misconception you have, which is, I think we did that one. The top-down business models are better than bottoms up and vice versa. Basically the consensus was it just kind of depends.
Yeah.
All right. So then the third one here is, get to it, switching costs apply to hard to rip out software only. So this one was interesting because when I read this, I was like, I definitely believe that one. And so when I read it, I was like, all right, this is apparently not true. So I'm gonna read the reality that you put, and then you can kind of riff off of that. So the reality in your eyes is switching costs can take multiple forms and need to be analyzed from the viewpoint of the customer.
So we just talked about Salesforce and CRM, right? So that's your traditional switching cost that everyone thinks about. And the other way to think about it would be like, a phone number. Like imagine how hard it is to switch off a phone number. So if every single time you switch to a different carrier, they made you switch your phone number, oh my God, like you just, you know, they have low churn anyway, but imagine like that would be zero churn, right? And so those are kind of traditional switching costs, extraordinarily hard because you'd have to tell all of your contacts, you'd have to do a bunch of data work, you have to do all these things that take a very long time. And so those are kind of well understood and why ServiceNow, Salesforce, Workday, all these companies out there are trading at, decent multiples and also at large market caps because they've been able to maintain these customers over time. But what's interesting is now you have product-led growth companies, right? And it's all about end users going and picking up and trying it and going from there. And so, someone would ask like, well, why would I use DocuSign? You know, why is DocuSign doing so well? There's Adobe Sign out there. There's HelloSign, which Dropbox just bought. I'm sure there's like someone started a random company in their mom's basement that's like a e-sign company, right? Like, why should I be using DocuSign, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing because yes, it's very easy to use, but think about what's happening. Like we're using Zoom right now, right? We could have used Google Meets, which is Google Video,
yeah, whatever they're called now.
I don't even know what they're called, but we could have used the Google products, right? And why did we choose Zoom? Because we've learned how easy it is with their calendar integrations to schedule it. We understand the UI. I know how to share my screen very easily. If I want to say congratulations to you, I can now put a reaction in, right? Like even just speaker views, like that's something I still haven't figured out in Google. Actually, is like whenever I go into Google, I'm like, wait, I want to go from single to double, or I want to go back to single or whatever, right? And I still don't know how to easily do that. I need to sit and spend time with the UI. That friction is a switching cost in and of itself, right? Mm. And so that's the same thing with DocuSign. Imagine if you've used DocuSign's UI because it was, you know, the earliest mover in the market, or just made it the simplest to be able to e-sign a document. Well, now all of a sudden, when you switch over to HelloSign, you have to learn a different UI. You have to learn where all the stuff is placed. How does it work? How do I assign the next leg of the next signature I need to get, right? Do I need to save the document now or will it send it back to me later? Like all these sort of things that you have to relearn. And that is a switching cost in and of itself. One of the funniest things I'll say is I don't know if you use Wunderlist or ever did, but it's a to-do task manager.
I use Trello. I think that's the only task manager I use right now.
Okay, got it. Yeah. Well, so Trello is actually the one that I should probably be using too, and stuff like that. But I still use Wunderlist, which is now Microsoft To Do. But it's really funny. Like there are so many to do lists out there. Like you could do it. You could do it within like just so many different areas to do it. So why do I use Wunderlist? Because it's the easiest. It's associated in my mind with to dos. So like, because of that, anytime I have a to-do, I'm not going to Apple Notes. I'm not going to my email. I'm not going to Notion. I'm not going to anything else. I'm popping open my to-do app, putting in my to-do, and that's it. And for me to change that workflow means cognitive load, means friction, means all these different things. So that's a new type of switching cost. Or I wouldn't say new type. It's been around for a very long time, but it's a behavioral switching cost. It's a different type of switching cost that then becomes harder over time as integrations get built in, as you get more ingrained into an end user's workflow. And so that's what I think is so powerful about these companies is Datadog, once they come in as the easiest to use monitoring product, now all of a sudden you can integrate them everywhere. You can have Slack messages come in. You can have email things. You can connect it with PagerDuty. You can do all these different components that make it so hard to rip out, because if you do it with somebody else, you have to learn their APIs, how their integrations work. And then also you got to figure out, well, hey, Datadog had a Microsoft Teams one, but this only has a Slack one. Like, what are we supposed to do? We're on Microsoft Teams, right? Like that sort of thing is just so hard to do. And so that's where these switching costs come into.
That's so good. And it's almost like you can look at, like we talked about, bottoms up versus top down models. And if you want to personalize that, you can almost take a top down approach to yourself as a customer, where you're focused on your workflow and kind of those embedded switching costs, right? So like, instead of a CRM at a 50 person enterprise, you're thinking, I don't want to rip out DocuSign because I've got an internal workflow that you've habitually created over, months and years. And Zoom was a perfect one. Like Zoom, and it's almost, it almost gets back to this idea of like, which company can become a verb first? You know, you've got like Uber became that verb first. Just Google it. No one says just Bing it. maybe except for like Microsoft employees, but no one says just Bing it. And now you're just like, all right, cool. Do you want to do a Zoom meeting? Like, no one's like, hey, do you want to do a Google Meets meeting? And then I guess it gets to a broader question of, do you just see these mega companies buying these hard to switch, these cognitive load businesses out? Because one of the things I saw, and I'll just go back to Twitter again, someone tweeted, and maybe you're referring to this tweet, but someone tweeted like, hey, why is DocuSign and whatever $1 billion market cap it is now, like, why is DocuSign this worth this much? Can't Microsoft just implement something right into its document app and do the same thing? So what is your reaction to that? Is it just, the UI is different, or do you see Microsoft just buying DocuSign and strapping it right inside?
Yeah, it's pretty funny because that's always the question, right? So absolutely, Microsoft could do it. G Suite could put it natively into Google Docs. Like, there's all these sort of different components. One thing is, platform agnostic really matters, right? So if Microsoft does something, it's going to work on Microsoft products, right? But it's not going to work on Adobe products. It's not going to work on whatever, Google products, right? And so having something like DocuSign, which works with whatever ingestion you have, makes a lot of sense. And again, then it turns into, what is DocuSign now doing to get further ahead? So once you cement your lead with the most customers that are using or things like that, you now have to expand into adjacent markets, right? And either products, you either can go more vertical in nature and go deeper into the product that you currently do, or you can expand horizontally into other areas. And so DocuSign went pretty far down the vertical funnel, right? They put in, now you can do checkboxes really easily, right? You can pretty much do document creation by putting in text box and like completely writing everything you need to do, such that now, like, any document, there's no excuse to not do it from an e-sign standpoint, right? Because you used to not be able to like type your name in a certain place, or like you need to change a word or whatever. Now DocuSign enables you to do that, right? So they went deep into that part of the workflow. But then what did they start to do? They started now to go into contract management, right? And to go into legal space, right? And all these other areas where these are adjacent workflows that, again, make it much more stickier. And so now if Microsoft comes out, yes, they could integrate it with Microsoft Word and go from there. But then the thing is DocuSign already does all these other things, right? So they have to go and catch up. And by the time they catch up, DocuSign's already helping solve another part of your workflow, right? And so this is the sort of kind of flywheel, or whatever. Flywheel is probably not the right word, but like the cadence.
Virtuous that cycle going, almost.
Yeah, the cadence that keeps going that enables these companies to stay in front. So that's kind of what's exciting. But I think you know, the main point is like, what we keep on going back to is, you know, we're talking about these different models, but like neither of them, like right now we're I would say as a ecosystem, we are over indexing on product-led growth because it's still something where, you know, the so-called older companies were, you know, Salesforce, Workday, all those companies are doing really well. Those were top-down models, but now the new companies like the Twilios, the Datadogs of the world, they're all kind of coming up bottoms up, right? And so it's really cool because you're getting to see them, you know, skyrocket in valuations and stuff like that. But I think it's important to say like relationship selling isn't going away, right? And yep. And certain product workflows mandate a CTO-led or CIO or top-down-led decision-making process, right? And so because of that, that is still going to generate large companies in the future, and we shouldn't weight one more than the other.
Yeah, and a perfect example of this is a company that I wrote about that just went public, I think it was a week ago, C3.ai. I'm not sure if you followed them or that company, but you know, basically one of the attractive things was it, you know, it took a long time for them to start initially getting customers because it was that top-down model where they had to basically tell the people why they needed to use the product, and they were only going to like the biggest customers in the industries. But then once they got those customers, they started buying more, they started using more of their services, and then that average time, that sales cycle shrunk down. And so it's going to be interesting to see over time if the pendulum swings back where the valuations are now product led, you know, the basically the valuations are high at the product led. Is that going to swing over time to a more top-down model, getting back to this idea of long-term returns? Because one can argue in a top-down model emphasizes long-term returns more than a product-led bottoms-up model, unless I'm wrong on that.
I wouldn't necessarily say emphasize it more, but to make the model work, you need to be assured of a longer LTV of your customer.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. And so because of that, implicitly you are making a very long-term bet because you're having right. to spend a bunch of upfront customer acquisition costs, right? Versus if you're Datadog, you can afford to churn out, you know, a decent amount of your SMB base because you're having more people come into the funnel, and then you're having the upsell happening in your you know top yep. top customers.
Got it. All right, cool. Let's move on to the fourth misconception here. Distribution only matters in consumer goods, not software. The reality, according to you, is distribution can create large moats in enterprise software. So expand on this for us.
Yeah. So, you know, this goes back to, and we've talked a lot about Salesforce, but this is probably one of the best companies I would say to study in this ecosystem because of how well they've executed. So, yeah. But you could use this with a number of other companies as well. But you know, again, when you look at a company like Salesforce, so they had their CRM product, they did really well. The question is now what, right? So you have this company, it's growing fast, but now the growth's starting to tail off. The free cash flow margins look good. Okay, do we sit there and start dividending out the cash flows and, you know, repurchasing shares? Maybe, and that could be, you know, what you could do. Or do we use that and start to expand into other areas? And so that's what Salesforce did, right? Is they bought ExactTarget for their sales cloud, I think it's called, or and then Demandware for their commerce cloud, and then they went out and bought MuleSoft, Tableau, like all these different companies, right? You know, most recently Slack, and they're creating all these different clouds. What's yep. interesting though is like they're going out and buying all these companies. How are they able, like MuleSoft's growth from when they bought it actually accelerated once it was within Salesforce, right? And that's a yeah. really interesting thing to study. How is that possible, right? It should be, you know, we're used to thinking linearly, right? So, hey, like if they were growing 50% this year, then next year they should be growing 40%, right? Because it's just sort of a linear growth pattern. And what happens is when you dig into Salesforce, you realize that what they have built is the best distribution engine out there in enterprise software, right? From a top-down sort of model. They have system integrators, Bain, BCG, McKinsey, all these different consulting firms that literally make money for themselves by deploying Salesforce. So they're going out and selling CRMs or all these other products that they acquire on because of the fact that they get the services work. That keeps their billings up, right? That makes them more profitable. And so you have this whole ecosystem of people that are selling for you outside of your direct sales force, right? So that's like crazy.
It's pretty good.
On top of that, you already have, you already have your direct sales force as well, right? And then you have all these other components where, you know, it's like that slotting fee for the grocery stores, right? Mm-hmm. You're top of mind, you're at the eye level. And so now if you have Tide and you want to put in Tide Febreze, well, guess what? You just move Tide down now either to the left or maybe down, and you put in Tide Febreze, right? And you start selling that maybe at a higher margin, but you still already have that lock-in, that distribution, that ecosystem. And so that's what makes Salesforce so interesting to study, is they've been able to take these companies, plug it into this distribution engine, and then actually expand the growth of these companies from there. So that's why it's like kind of really interesting is from a product standpoint, actually Salesforce's product suite may not be as good as some other companies out there, right? On a CRM basis, like some may argue that their CRM is actually frankly dated at this point compared to others. But that being said, they built up this distribution engine that Accenture is not going and selling the new cool CRM company. They're selling Salesforce's CRM, right? Because that's what makes them the most money. So that's one type of distribution. The other one is kind of more of like the Atlassian model or the MongoDB or the Elastic one, which is more of you have all of these people coming to your website or this community that's built around you that wants to try out the product, evangelizes others to try it out, contributes code to the open source or just kind of talks about how they use the product in their workflows. And what that then engenders is another form of distribution where you already have this community, you have these developers that look to you to think about, hey, what are you guys doing? How are you going to improve this product? And you can now bring in an adjacent product. So Atlassian did it with Bitbucket, with HipChat, which, you know, didn't work out, but OpsGenie, StatusPage, like all these companies where they're acquiring, putting it into that distribution engine, that's all coming from these developers and now the channel partners that they built up. But these developers that come to the website anyway, and now like all of a sudden, hey, OpsGenie's bundled in with this, like, why don't I use that for my alerting, right? And it's just a very easy type of sale.
Yeah, and it's almost like going back to your comment about Salesforce maybe not being the best CRM out there, it makes me think of Bloomberg terminals where everybody kind of dogs on the UI of the Bloomberg terminal, but yet everybody still uses it. And why? It's because it's the best at distributing breaking news and financial data to financial professionals. It's so interesting. And it also makes you wonder, like, how do you then create, like, what are some of the ways that you can create like the next distribution king or queen? Like, what's like, how do you create the next Salesforce? How do you create the next Atlassian? It might not look the same, but like, what are some things that companies can do? Maybe you can even give us examples from like your seed investments or from companies that you're interested in where they're trying to create this distribution hub to then create more value.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting because, I would say what we start to talk to a lot of companies about now is actually doing more of a sandwich model, right? So take some parts of both. So if you are a top-down sort of sales motion, you can still learn a lot about community around empowering this product-led growth, around serving these end users. And so what we call that is a sandwich model, right? Which is, hey, if you're going top-down, you should still be focused on this end user and trying to evangelize them. And you can take that from some of these product-led companies. Conversely, if you're a product-led growth company, you should be thinking about what can you do on the top-down sales side to start learning how to sell to these enterprises and how to get that motion going. So I think the best companies in the future will actually be a hybrid. Like no longer, especially with the capital flowing into the ecosystem, Atlassian built their model because of capital constraints. There just wasn't capital there for them to do what they were doing, right? Well, now the next Atlassian is going to be, you know, likely venture funded, have plenty of capital to execute. And so they can actually take the best of both and start to build out a really attractive combination business. And so, you know, from our portfolio, like I would say Sneak is doing this really well, right? Like they had their core open source product. They just moved into container security, which they built out internally. And then they actually just acquired a startup to move into an adjacent category, but all developer first, all going from a security angle and using kind of this bottoms up developer love that they've engendered to kind of keep moving into these existing, into these other adjacent categories. And so that's what's really exciting, right? That's what gets us, you know, they raised at a $2.6 billion valuation. And the reason for that is because people are betting that they're going to be able to not only execute in the products that they already do very well at, but start to move into further adjacencies such that now, like, you have CrowdStrike or you know,
up another 10% today.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you have these companies, but what's really interesting, if you look at the security ecosystem, every single company is top down. It's because security historically, and even now for most aspects of security, has been an enterprise sale. Sneak is the first company to go developer first in security. And that's what's so exciting, right? Is imagine bringing this bottoms up led, you know, model into an industry where it's typically been top down. What could you do? How much market share could you take? And that's what gets us really excited about the potential there.
Why do you think security as a specific industry has been so top down historically?
Basically, the reason is like, if you think about security from a standpoint of a developer, most developers just, they want to be able to ship their code. They want to write beautiful code. They want to do crazy machine learning things. Like, they want to do exciting stuff, right? Security is not exciting. to be honest, it's protecting your flank, right? And it's making sure you don't get hacked. And so where does that typically come down from? That's more of a top-down sort of thing, because a CTO will say, oh my God, if we get hacked, we're going to have to pay a $30 million fine. We're going to lose customers. We're going to do all this stuff. And so then they're going to tell the individual developers, hey, you guys need to be worried about security, right? Now, what Sneak did was they made it really easy for developers to just not even have to think about it, right? You could just deploy Sneak. It will automatically find vulnerabilities in the open source libraries. It will remediate them, and boom, like, all of a sudden as a developer, you're just still coding. It's remediating.
You're going back to what you actually want to do.
Exactly. But at the same time, you're making your code more secure, right? And so that's really exciting, because you still have the CTO telling you, hey, you need to make sure security is a first priority. But now you get to just do what you love while this thing's kind of handling it for you, right? Sneak's handling it for you. So, but that's why it's traditionally been top down, and why it will continue to be a model that works very well in security, because of the fact that this is something that is much more, in terms of a behavioral thing, a top down sort of problem that people care about.
And cybersecurity is such an interesting space. I'm actually looking, there's two public companies I'm looking at now. One's in Germany, one's in the US, recent IPO. And one of the really impressive things about it is the costs of not having a cybersecurity protocol or software or something like that in place are astronomical and probably cover, I mean, this is obviously just a random number, like 2, 3, 5x what that product would cost to protect you. And so there's this inherent positive economics for the customer where it's like, okay, you know, let's say we pay, again, these are random numbers. Let's say we pay $10,000 a year for Sneak or for this other cybersecurity, but it saves us. It's basically like an insurance policy where you're paying $10,000 a year for cybersecurity to protect you from what could happen. And so it's interesting to kind of think about cybersecurity from like an insurance perspective, where it kind of changes the way you think about how a company would expense that and, you know, just how much they're willing to spend.
Yeah, it's so one of the really interesting companies in our portfolio is called Security Scorecard. And where they came out was they came out with the security ratings market, right? Which was when you're assessing vendors, how do you actually know what their security posture is, right? And then internally also, how do you understand your own security posture and where your weaknesses are, right? And so they give you like scores like A, B, C, whatever. And then through there, you can understand, okay, here's where I can improve and go upon. But what's really cool is Moody's actually invested in them. And why did Moody's invest in them? Because imagine if, not if actually, we believe when security ratings become as important as credit ratings, right? Hmm. It should be something where if you're Equifax, that was a meaningful breach, right? And that lost them for a period of time, a decent amount of shareholder value, right? And set them back probably from where they would have been now, where their stock would have been quite a bit. And so if you could remove that, right, that would be really cool. So imagine if now security ratings affect your debt costs or your financing costs. And so that's where we get pretty excited about in the future.
Yeah. And it's just, it's another thing that's so interesting about it too, is you've got these software companies, these security companies that they get incrementally better. And then you've got the virtuous cycle of data and machine learning, where the more vulnerabilities you see, the more that you can document, the better your then internal algorithm becomes at recognizing these. So there's almost like another first mover element too, where if you can get inside these companies and you can start seeing more vulnerabilities, your model is going to be incrementally better than another person that's seen less of those vulnerabilities.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the big hype that everyone talks about now is like machine learning and AI and, you know, kind of all these things. And the funny thing about machine learning is, first and foremost, it starts with the data ingestion problem, right? Because if you don't have the data, it starts with data ingestion, because not only do you have to have the data, but you have to have it clean, you have to have it labeled, you have to have it in an accessible format such that you can call upon it easily.
Yep.
And then finally you can get to the ML piece, right?
Yeah.
So that's why it's so interesting, like why people are so excited about Snowflake, right? And why people are so excited about, you know, these extract, transform, load companies, ETL companies that make it easier to do that process. Because yes, machine learning is definitely kind of the holy grail. It can make a ton of improvements. And we're seeing it, you know, in companies all over the place. I mean, Google decreased their data center costs by like some astronomical amount by acquiring DeepMind, right? Which went in there and figured out how to optimize that through machine learning. But before that, you still have this data problem before you can get to the machine learning models. And that's like the exciting part is as we get hyped up about certain areas, it's interesting to take kind of a more of a first principles approach of like, hey, I get why this is going to be big. That's really cool. And maybe I do want to make a bet on, you know, I know you're bullish about NVIDIA or companies like that about, hey, this is something that's exciting that's going to enable this. But what's the root cause of this? And so even in NVIDIA's case, that's what's really cool is like, you need those chips to be able to do the ML, right?
Yep.
Before you can even empower the software. So there's all these underlying nested layers to this end state that we're going to. And that's what fascinates me about software, right? It goes back to all these different dependencies that they all overlap on each other. And you need a certain chip that's optimized for this thing that has this data coming in, you know, for something to happen.
Yeah, and it's funny because we're one of the positions that we're big on at MacroOps is Micron, which is, you know, chip, obviously, you know, huge chip maker. And then another company is Murata Manufacturing, which manufactures MLCCs. And it's just so interesting when you go through the supply chain. And one way to think about it, and I just kind of thought about this from talking to you, because honestly, talking to you has made me realize like how much the qualitative matters from like a supply chain standpoint, in the sense of where can you find areas within these exciting industries that people don't like to do the work, right? So people love coding, but they don't like to do the cybersecurity part. People love machine learning, but they don't like doing the CRUD that you need to do on the data to actually get it to work. And so something that's interesting to think about maybe from like a broad investment thesis is like find these really cool things and then find where people hate doing the thing that they need to do to get to the thing that they want to do.
I think that's a fascinating way to look at it. And frankly, that's what a lot of infrastructure investing is, right? Like where we invest a lot of times is deep software infrastructure. And these are unsexy areas, right? It's not something where someone wakes up in the morning, but hey, it would be really cool if we could run, attacks on our systems to expose latency, right? Like that wouldn't be something that anybody would be excited about, right? But like you can get companies that when they do that, help to create these super powerful systems that can help achieve end states for a product that no one ever imagined before, right? And that's where it gets exciting. So sometimes that boring stuff that's tucked away is actually where a lot of value can lie.
Yeah, it's almost like the dirty jobs for the 21st century and beyond. Where instead of like at a pig farm, you're at a data field or a data lake and just trying to do a bunch of CRUD. Like maybe that's maybe that's the next generation of dirty jobs. You know, if people, someone listening, if they've made it this far, is someone like, you know what, I'm going to take that idea. I'm going to go to Discovery Plus and I'm going to make millions off of that. But I just want a shout out. That's all I want.
I don't think that would work well for a show though. You know, Dirty Jobs like was such a cool show because he like goes through the sewer and like he does that stuff. Imagine Dirty Jobs for enterprise software.
You're
like,
just sitting there.
I don't think that works as well.
You're like, so now I go to lunch. Man, that's too fun. It's actually funny. I want to get Mike Rowe on the podcast, like for nothing related to investing at all, but just to like talk to him about dirty jobs. Maybe I could put something in there about investing, but who knows?
I'm sure he has some exciting things to talk about with investing, because like even just coming up with that show idea, like that's just such a cool idea. And like I just want to talk to him about how do you go, like when you're in a sewer, what do you do from like a nose standpoint? How do you deal with that?
Like let's talk about personal hygiene, Mike. That's awesome. Oh man, I love that tangent there. Let's kind of rope it back here, wrapping up. I know you've been super generous with your time, and I just kind of want to finish up about talking about investing along the enterprise software stack and kind of what areas excite you the most. I know we've discussed kind of on a high level what companies and kind of top down versus bottom, but along the software stack, where are you seeing, whether it's at Bold Start or whether, you know, doing what you do very sparingly in the public markets, what areas of the enterprise software stack get you excited the most?
Yeah, so, you know, I think one of the most mission critical systems that you could ask for out there is infrastructure, right? So that's always where a deep passion of mine is going to lie, which is, what is software running on? And understanding, again, how that fits into an end user's workflow to really understand what's that mission criticality, right? So if I can find those companies, that's what gets me excited, because I think the long-term performance of those products is far outside of any imagination that we could ever think about, right? So we spend a lot of time, I would say, at Boldstar, but also personally, even in my investment portfolio, like the companies I mentioned, Datadog, MongoDB, Elastic, like these sort of companies are that mission criticality layer that many different companies are running their software systems on. The other side I would say is kind of more of reimagining an existing category. And so for that, where we get excited about is like, you know, a company like Superhuman in our portfolio, it's the fastest email experience that you could ask for. But why is that exciting? Well, Rahul literally came in, had his first slide deck, which, you know, I wasn't around at the time when he pitched, but I've seen it now. And it's just like literally a picture of Gmail with him just like slashing things that shouldn't be. Like literally, he's just like, why is this in the UI? Why is this in the UI? Why is this, you know? And and so now if you're a Superhuman user, all of that sort of crap that's in Gmail is now nested in a nice command line where you can do Control K, you can have different things, and then there's different keyboard shortcuts that allow you to call that. But that's reimagining an existing category. Like Gmail's been around so long, email, Yahoo Mail, like who would have thought that would be something that you could, you know, create something valuable on top of by changing the design and the speed of that. And that's what Superhuman has done and done very successfully. And so that's another layer where in the application stack, we get excited about folks that are reimagining either through a unique data model or through a different design and speed approach that can greatly augment the user experience. When we find those, we get pretty excited.
Got it. And that's so interesting how important UI is, because you can't quantify. I mean, I guess you can try, but in my head, I'm like, how do you quantify saying this UI is better because of, you know, X, Y, Z? It's almost like a personal preference extrapolated over the masses. That's so fascinating. What trends are you seeing in enterprise software that you think have the potential to generate the most alpha over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years? If you could give, you know, basically like if you can invest in one part of the stack and you could only invest in one part, which one would it be?
So, this goes towards my bent with infrastructure, but I would say developer efficiency is something that is still, developer efficiency and productivity is still something that is meaningfully undervalued. And there's a couple different ways of that. One is, you know, developer tools, right? So like the Twilios, the Stripes of the world that enable you to do something that you had to do commonly before, but now makes it very easy to just call an API and not have to worry about that. And so that's making developers more productive. But how do you actually, like the other thing that gets me excited is actually the tooling that developers use every day to actually, build the code, right? Build the product that they're gonna ship. There's different areas of that you could start to iterate on at the container level, at the CI/CD level, at the, you know,
even within the APIs, how are those called? How are those mapped? How can you understand what systems they're interacting with? There's so many different areas to that that we at Bolt Start get very excited about. Me personally get very excited about all of those things that you can do to make developers more efficient, because we think that that's got huge amounts of runway as more and more companies become software first, as we're seeing through COVID. So that's a long tailwind that we think is going to have many different iterations. And even we're seeing it now where, continuous integration, continuous deployment tools, CICD, they're called, these build pipelines are now having like second and third versions of them coming out, because people have taken learnings that they've seen from the first iterations and now starting to come out with, hey, here's a new way to do this, or here's how it could integrate with Kubernetes better, or different things like that, that allow you to have a much more efficient process. So that's what gets us excited.
Are you seeing that deployed in mainly the US, or are there any other countries that are kind of leading this charge? And I don't know if you guys invest globally or not either.
Yeah, so we do invest globally. In fact, I think like half of our current portfolio companies of our, VC funds are structured as you have certain investments in each fund. And so we're on our fourth fund right now, I think about 18 companies. And so half of them are based in London, Israel, France, Germany, kind of all over the place. And I think what's exciting about that is, again, we go back to this, what's happening from a product-led growth standpoint of if you're building a product that serves one end user very well, and that's a workflow that makes sense, right? And again, so, as we described earlier, there's some products that it doesn't make sense for, but some that it does. A lot of those products are doing really well, actually, internationally. The reason for that is that from the beginning, they're de facto being built with like, hey, we don't even speak the language, so like can't do this consultative selling because we don't even like know how to sell to somebody, right? And so instead, they have to go product led. So they have to build an amazing product. They have to, because of those constraints, figure out a way to build a community around it, get it adopted. And so increasingly, we're seeing those companies actually do quite well in international markets. Plus, the developer salaries are also lower usually. And so you actually get more capital efficient companies as well in some of these areas. So you can build a business anywhere. Hopefully as investors, we'll find you wherever you are and help you build your company.
It's funny you mentioned the capital efficiencies, because I was just talking to one of our members in our Matt Grops Collective about ex-US investments. And one area that I'm really bullish on is Poland, for that exact reason, where you have killer Polish software development talent for fractions of what they would cost in the US, and what you can do with that to leverage your operating structure and your operating margins is incredible.
It's what's the big hack that just happened recently, like the US Homeland Security and Treasury or something just got hacked.
Yeah, I just saw that this morning.
Yeah, and I think it was hacked by, I think the news I saw was by Russia. And so I got to tell you, like, Russian developers have a much different salary expectation than a San Francisco Bay Area developer. But the feats that both personas are able to pull off is equally amazing, right? And so I think that's where I think that's a trend that we're going to see more and more, especially brought about by COVID, where you can start to leverage more resources in Romania, Ukraine. I mean, UiPath is going to go public. We already saw this with Zoom with China, but UiPath just filed to go public and has a massive team in Romania of developers. And that's led them to be able to be just as fast as any American-based developer company out there, and still been able to iterate quickly, have great success, and probably leads to better steady state margins from that company, right? So I think that's a pretty fascinating trend.
What does UiPath do?
So UiPath, what they do is what's called robotic process automation. So they basically help you create automated bots that can do certain things. So for example, let's say you have to input certain things into a contract. A lot of those are kind of rules-based things, like you need your name here, you need your you need the date here, you need whatever kind of things like that. And so that should be automated. And there's a lot of other work that you can automate. So billing workflows, legal documents. I mean, just there's so many different use cases. It's kind of hard to say. Yeah. And so UiPath basically helps create bots that automate that and is expanding into other areas. RPA in general is a very large area where you have process mining, process discovery, you have kind of bot automation, and then you also have like workflow automation as well. And so those are all different components of this broad umbrella, but UiPath is kind of touching all of those.
Got it. Let's move to the closing questions. I mean, we're about to go to an hour and a half, which I think is awesome. This is just flown by. And I know people are going to get just so much value out of this. What is one thing you're trying to improve on looking into 2020 that, or 2021, I'm sorry, that you would like to, you know, see meaningful improvement on, whether it's, you know, personal, professional, investment life, all you.
Yeah. I would say, one of the things that I've realized is, I think, my network has been fairly localized in the sense of just you fall into when it's non-COVID times, you're grabbing coffee with somebody and you're grabbing drinks and whatever. And what ends up happening is you kind of people obviously fly into your area or you'll fly into those areas, but you end up being kind of localized and have a localized network. And so that's something where I want to improve upon, where I realized that during COVID, even like I'd be forgetting about, someone in San Francisco that I should catch up with, or someone in Utah, or, whatever, yep. because I wasn't traveling there, right? Normally I'd be like, hey, I'm going to be in your city. Like, let's catch up. And that's something I really want to be more mindful of, because I think, we have, our friends are everywhere, right? And it shouldn't be based on proximity to where you live. And so that's something that I really want to improve upon.
Got it. Now, last question that I ask everybody. If you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought about this question a lot, because you sent it over in the outline, and I was like, oh my God, this is good. This is a good one.
Stumps everybody.
and I think the answer for me would be Charlie Munger. Charlie Munger, I think the reason why I would say him is if you read Poor Charlie's Almanac, which is a compilation of all of his talks and writings and all those sort of things, what you realize is that while I've always like idolized him as this investor that's done so well and everything like that, he is the shrewdest and smartest person I know in terms of thinking through psychology, behavioral tendencies, and incentives, right? And I think that's something where more and more everything we look at is like again, when if we boil down to what software is, it's human coordination building things, right? And yep. So given that cultural dynamics, the ability to lead others, to motivate others, to incent them is so important. And even in our personal lives, Charlie Munger's done some amazing things. He lost a son very early on and was able to get past that and still, have his family do quite well and get past that. And so that's something that I think there's so much to learn from him. And so every time he speaks, he just spoke at Caltech. I kind of drop everything and just listen to take notes. And so that's someone who I would love to have dinner with.
Yeah, it was crazy in my own like sphere. It seemed like everybody was dropping a webinar at the same time. Like I had like Steve Mandel did a charity thing, and then Charlie Munger did something else. It seemed like someone else had something else. So it's like I've got all these bookmarked ready to watch on the weekend. So it was it's also so awesome how that stuff is just given away for free. Like you get to learn about Charlie Munger, whose information is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars probably. And you just get to listen to him for free for an hour.
I think his information is probably worth because people bid on their, these dinners.
Oh, true. You can actually quantify this. Yeah.
So it's probably actually worth like a couple million or something
Yeah.
But it's amazing. I mean, I think COVID has really kind of accelerated a lot of trends, unfortunately, in the way that's happened. But I think fortunately now it's even kind of reworked mindsets. Like we used to have to meet founders before we'd invest in them. So we'd literally fly out to Germany. We'd fly out to different places to sit and kind of look them in the eye and be like, hey, we want to get to know you. And what we've realized is like, you can do that much more efficiently over Zoom. And you can have dinners, you can have cocktails, you can do all that over Zoom it obviously isn't the same as when you're in person. It's more enjoyable when you're in person, but you can still do that. And I think that's what's been cool is even democratizing, like when I've been talking to founders recently in India, that's an area where normally I probably wouldn't have thought as much about investing in just because of the time difference and things like that. And now with COVID and all these, tooling that we have, that's much more readily accessible and something that I'm like, actually, I can do that, right? From New York, it is actually not that hard to invest in India and back companies there.
Yeah, and I think we took for granted. Well, I know I did personally. I took for granted that the physical time that I had with people, and you don't really appreciate that obviously until once that's stripped from you. And unfortunately, we've been in the circumstance where that has. But going forward, I saw a tweet where someone said, "I understand why they called it the Roaring Twenties." And people just wanted to get dressed and go out to get groceries. I was like, that's so, it's so true because it makes the time that you can spend in physical contact with someone, it makes that time way more valuable than before. And I think that that's a net positive going forward, regardless of what happens.
I completely agree. Looking forward to, the roaring 2021s coming out here soon. And hopefully, just being able to meet people in person and enjoy time with everyone. I mean, I think like I definitely took it for granted and so excited for that to be back to normal.
Yeah. Shomik, where can people go to find more about you?
So on Twitter, I'm at ShomikGhosh21, just first name, last name, 21. You can find me on LinkedIn, shomik@boldstart.vc is my email. So, open to talk with anybody who reaches out.
Awesome. This has been a blast learning about enterprise software, switching costs, network effects, and just really the power that habit has on building a business. Can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and I look forward to chatting with you again.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brandon. Really appreciate it.